Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore for tonight's mini screenwriting workshop with Neil Landau. First, I want to start off by thanking you all for supporting your local independent bookseller and coming out on a Friday night to be at the Tattered Cover. It's folks like you that make what we do possible, and we can't have these events without you. So tonight we have Neil Landau. It's my pleasure to welcome him to the store. He is going to talk a little bit about his new book, The Screenwriting Roadmap. Screenwriter's Roadmap. Neil is a professor of screenwriting at both UCLA and USC. His film credits include Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, Melrose Place, Doogie Howser, and a number of other very successful films and TV shows. Without further ado, Neil.
Well, thank you for coming out on a Friday night right before the holidays. I was here about 3 years ago promoting this book, 101 Things I Learned in Film School, which is still on the bestseller list, which has been very surprising to me because it's this little book with these little short lessons, and it's now been translated into 7 languages. The most recent one, it's been translated into Chinese, but I have all these editions at home in Japanese, French, Spanish, Russian, Turkish. It's just been really interesting, and I want to talk first just to give you a little little background on the genesis of this book. After this book came out, which became, you know, did pretty well, I was contacted by Focal Press, who's my new publisher, and they said, are you interested in doing another book? And I have been teaching at this point now for about 17 years. And when I first started to teach at UCLA, I made a little handout, and it was 7 questions to ask yourself before you start writing your script, and I gave it to all my students. It then turned into 10 questions, and then over the years it kept growing, and it turned into 21 questions. And it was just this little handout that I made up. And over the years, everybody would say, not everybody, but my students would say, you should write a screenwriting book, and you should do it on the 21 questions. And I would say, yeah, you know, someday, maybe when I'm 50, I'll write that book. Well, guess what? In about 2.5 weeks, I'll be 50. And it feels like it was about, you know, a month ago that I said that, and it's amazing how quickly time is going by. The big difference between the new book and this book is this book is very much for people who are interested in writing screenplays. It talks about the architecture of screenplays, the structure of screenplays, character development, theme. And the other big difference is that when they approached me to write the book, I said, well, you know, I feel that there are already too many books on screenwriting in the bookstores. And the thing I don't like about a lot of those books is the writers act like they know everything and that there's one way to write a screenplay. And yet, with only maybe one or two exceptions, the people who have wrote those books don't have any credits and have never written a successful screenplay. So I felt like, you know, I've had a little bit of success, but I felt like I'm not on the mountaintop, and I don't want to pretend to be. So I am not here to tell you I have all the answers, and that there is one way to write a screenplay. So I said, well, I only want to do the book if I can interview very, very successful screenwriters who, you know, have won Oscars and who have written, you know, huge box office success films and films that have defined the times in which they were written and the times in which we live. And so that became really exciting to me because selfishly I thought I'll get to procrastinate writing my half of the book and spend a year interviewing all of these people. And it also gave me kind of an all access pass because Of the 21 interviews in the book, three of them are my former students who have become phenomenally successful. One of my former students is Melissa Rosenberg, and she wrote all the Twilight movies. She also used to be the executive producer of Dexter. And if you look in the book, in the chapter on Where is the Heat, that was one of the first interviews that I booked. And David Koepp, who wrote Jurassic Park and Spider-Man and War of the Worlds and Panic Room and so many huge blockbuster movies. I'm about to knock something over. Hang on. We went to film school together at UCLA. We're still friends. So I had a few easy yeses when I approached people to do the interviews. And then once I had like five or six big names, then it was a lot easier to approach the people I didn't know, because I was able to say, hey, I have these other people. And the selfish part was that I felt like I'd gotten into a, not so much of a rut, but I'd been teaching kind of the same ideas over and over year after year in my screenwriting classes and workshops. Right, doing the research for this book and interviewing all of these people really, it reinvigorated me. It gave me a lot of different perspectives. It showed me that there's so many different ways for people to approach the process of writing a script. For example, you know, for a long time, I really insisted that all my students outline their scripts and do what's called a step outline, where you lay out every single scene in the movie before you start writing. It's something that I still really like to do, and I do it with index cards, and there's a whole chapter in here on structure. All the chapters are in the form of questions, so the chapter on structure is called What's the Structural Blueprint? And I'd also really like to kind of pin down my theme before I started to write. I wanted to know, you know, when I think about theme, it's there's the movie and then there's what the movie is really about. So outlining and pinning down theme were really important to me, and I really insisted that my students do it. Well, half the people I interviewed of these 21 don't outline at all. They just start writing and find it as they go. Half the people said theme was the most polarizing question. More than half the people said, no, you should never think about theme. It's going to just become pretentious and heavy-handed. So it really changed the way I teach. I don't make them outline anymore unless they want to. I say it's an optional step. I do ask them to tell me what their movie's about. And I have a new exercise now that sounds easy, but pretty much anything that's worth doing, it sounds easy. Like, how hard could it be to play basketball? You know, just throw the ball in the hoop. But I do this thing called the 1-3-3 exercise, which is just tell me what your movie's about in one sentence, then tell me what your movie's about in three sentences, and then tell me what your movie's about in three paragraphs. And it breaks down basically just beginning, middle, end. I think that the discovery process when you're actually writing the pages is so valuable, and when you sit in the chair at your computer or wherever you write, there's things that just come to you, you know, that you might not think about in the planning stages. And I feel like sometimes if you do too much pre-planning and too much outlining and you nail down the theme too much, you kind of remove the, you kind of in some ways, it may even restrict your imagination, because you're creating a lot of limitations before you've even started. So I've definitely switched over to that, and it's there's more of a relationship, I guess, that I would say I have with my muse now than before, where I was so anxious about knowing every scene before I started that it became almost like a big block of ice that I had to break before I started. And a lot of people suffer and struggle with either writer's block, or they just spend forever researching so they don't have to actually start writing, because it's really terrifying to start writing. You know, we talk about the, you know, right now, or, you know, the fiscal cliff in Washington. Well, the creative cliff is, you know, the terror of having to face this huge project that's in front of you. And I like to get students starting to write really quickly. And I'll say, sometimes I'll just say, here's your assignment this week. You need to bring in 10 really, really shitty pages next week. That's actually your assignment. And they're like, we have to write 10 shitty pages? I said, yes, you are allowed to write 10 terrible pages, just as long as you bring in 10 pages, because maybe they're not as bad as you think. And probably if you free yourself up from being perfectionistic, you'll find that you're much more creative. You know, the best, how many people here have writing aspirations or write either fiction or, okay, well, there you go. How many people are fiction writers and how many would consider yourself screenwriters? And what else? Poets, lyricists, memoir, creative nonfiction. Well, I think that I always say to my students, if anybody who's creative at some point has struggled with writer's block, so this is the best thing I ever heard about that, the antidote to writer's block. You know what it is? Lower your standards. Just that's where the 10 shitty pages come from. You know, just lower your standards. Just get something down. So anyway, I interviewed 21 people to get their perspectives. My goal was that they would all disagree with each other and that one person would say, research is everything. You must research, you know, for months and know your subject inside and out. And then another person doesn't research at all. That was the most surprising of all the interviews. I interviewed a screenwriter, a director named Guillermo Arriaga. He wrote a movie called Amoros Perros, which is an amazing movie. And he wrote Babel, and he wrote 21 Grams. And he doesn't outline, he doesn't research, and he doesn't rewrite. This was the most unusual of the things. So if you saw Babel, part of Babel takes place in Morocco, and there's the, you know, Cate Blanchett and Brad Pitt are on vacation, and she gets shot through the window of a bus. It's this freak accident. And I said, well, how did you set it in Morocco when you've never, I said, so you've never been to Morocco? He said, no, I've never been to Morocco. And if you look at Babel, one of the stories is a deaf Japanese girl in Tokyo, Japanese teenage girl and her friends. He's never been to Japan. He's never been to Tokyo. I said, well, how did you know is anybody in your family deaf? No. And I'm not advocating this, by the way. I'm just telling you that this was an interesting thing that I found. He said, I just imagined I have a teenage daughter. I just imagine that they're similar in different parts of the world. And I just imagined what a Japanese teenage girl would be like in Tokyo. And so that was like the very far end of the spectrum in terms of not researching. He doesn't rewrite because his background is as a novelist, and he spends a very long time writing, and he doesn't commit anything to paper until he feels very certain that that's what he wants and it feels right. And then when he's done, he's done. He rewrites maybe as he's going along, but he doesn't do what most screenwriters do, which I do advocate, is try to get a draft done as quickly as you can and then go back and revise. I do so much rewriting. A big part of my living now is doing script doctoring and doing rewrites of scripts. I like to clean up messes. And the reason I like to do rewrites of other people's scripts is that I'm not anxious the same way, and I have more objectivity because I can see the problems and I can see, I'm able to kind of, I'm a little bit removed from it, and then I have to, of course, inhabit it in order to write it. But I believe a lot in rewriting, and a lot of times people ask me, like, what are the biggest mistakes aspiring screenwriters make? And it's not just screenwriters, but it's probably particularly prevalent with screenwriters, which is they send out their scripts before they're ready. You know, they're so anxious to break in and to make a sale and to do something that they send out a script that is maybe 30 or 40% there. They might think it's further along than it is, but it's a long process. I have, you know, I'll do 15, 20 drafts easily. And on the animated movies I've been working on now, because there's a director and there are producers and there's a team, it's a 3 or 4 year process from the time the initial script is done. Then they do animatics, which are like the pencil drawings. Then it goes through all these renderings of art direction. And I'm able to rewrite through all of those stages. The last thing that gets animated are the movements of the mouth. And that's when we do the voices. And this animated movie that I wrote that's going to come here next year, I was rewriting dialogue on locked picture, meaning I was in London in a dubbing stage, and I could rewrite lines as long as it matched the lips that were already animated to the syllable. So the actors were in the booth, and I knew what, and doing it on a tight time frame because the sound engineers were there, the director was there, the actors were there, and thinking like, I know what I think the line should be that would be funnier or better, but it has to have the exact right amount, number of syllables. So we're going to try to avoid that this time. The talk, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the role of mystery and suspense to give you a little bit of nuts and bolts of screenwriting. And then if anybody has any questions, I'll answer those. And then the main reason we're here, I will be happy to sign books. If you would like to buy 10 or 20 books each as Christmas presents, it's a 10-drink minimum. In this case, it's a 10-book minimum. Okay, so one of the reason that I really feel like every screenwriting guru or teacher has their thing, you know, that defines what they really like to talk about. I like to talk about three things in particular. One, the idea that of positive and negative energy. If you look at a battery, it has a plus sign and a minus sign on the battery. And I always enter a screenwriting class and write on the board, where is the heat? Where is the heat? Which means, where's the dramatic fire? Where's the intensity? And where's the suspense in the story? And where's the central conflict? When you put a negative charge against a positive charge, it generates heat. It generates a spark. In movies, they're basically just very simply about an iconic character, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but a really interesting, complex, compelling character who's fascinating or magnetic in some way, who is thrust into some kind of extraordinary situation. And then movies are about how those kinds of characters perform under pressure. You know, they have to be under pressure. Has anybody seen the movie Flight with Denzel Washington? Because I think that movie, well, there were a couple of things that I really liked about it. One was that it was deep and pushed this character very far to the edge in a way that I haven't seen a lot in movies lately, because most movies are just tend to be lighter and more superficial. And I really liked how they really were able to dig into that character. Flight has an iconic character, and the way I define an iconic character, his name is Whip, played by Denzel Washington in the movie. And an iconic character is a protagonist, a main character, who contains a core contradiction, something that is positive and something that is negative. So in Flight, you have a alcoholic, drug addict, deadbeat dad, irresponsible, selfish, narcissistic, you know, basically a child in a man's body. But there's embedded in his character is this core contradiction, which is that he's this airline pilot, and not only is he an airline pilot, but he's a damn good airline pilot. And he lands this plane, and they determined that nobody, trained pilots in flight simulators, could not have landed that plane successfully. Not only was he able to do it with just minimal casualties, but there were some people who died, but he did it while he was under the influence of alcohol and cocaine. So you have a guy who's extremely good at his job, who does this amazing heroic feat, but he's this complete mess on the inside, and he's trying to destroy himself. So you have a guy who's both a rescuer and a destroyer. He's self-destructive. He's also destructive to the people around him. His ex-wife doesn't want him around their child. So you have a really fascinating character. It helps that he's played by Denzel Washington, who's not only a great actor, but he's one of the most likable, charismatic actors out there. So we start with an iconic character, positive, negative, light, dark. When you think of all iconic characters, look at, they can be protagonists, they can be antagonists. Hannibal Lecter is brilliant. He's a gourmet. He's a doctor. But he's also a serial killer and a cannibal, you know? Scarlett O'Hara is incredibly willful, incredibly tempestuous. And at the same time, she's very fragile, you know? And she's needy. She's both tough and sensitive, both of those things exist at the same time. And that's another thing that you see in iconic protagonists. And there's the whole book. I mean, pretty much every character in all the movies that are talked about in here. So how do they perform under pressure? You're thrusting them into a situation where they must do something. And which means they have a positive goal where they must accomplish something. And if they don't, there will be consequences, which in the screenwriting trade we call stakes. So they have something to gain, something to win, and if they don't succeed at their goal, they have something to lose. They have something to, there'll be a consequence for not taking an action. If you if you create a protagonist who doesn't, who must, it needs to be a goal that's based on necessity. If you create a protagonist who kind of wants to do something, that's not strong enough to sustain a movie. It has to be that he must do something, or she must. Sometimes, depending on the genre, it's predicated on total necessity, like in Contagion, which is one of the interviews I did in the book is Scott Z. Burns, who wrote Contagion. Did you guys see that? Steven Soderbergh, really suspenseful movie, right? Which also, and it also contains a mystery. But that's an emergency, you know? So goals and stakes when there's an emergency are much more clear. But when there isn't a goal where that is based on physical, practical needs, it has to feel like life and death stakes for the character. So the Twilight movies, you may or may not be a fan of them, but what they do is they've created both Stephanie Myers, the author, and Melissa Rosenberg, who wrote the screenplays. You have a teenage girl, and to her, if she can't be with Edward, she feels like she'll die, you know? So the stakes for her are very internal. Nothing will really happen to her, we know, especially if you're an adult watching it. When my son tells me, my older son tells me that he just broke up with another girlfriend, and every other week there's a new one, I'm thinking from my almost 50-year-old perspective, like, you're 14, you know? There's going to be so many of them. It doesn't matter. But to him, it feels like the end of the world. You need the situations you put your characters in to feel like the end of the world for them. Within the world you've created, it has to have credible stakes that feel like life and death, even when they're not life and death. A positive goal with the hope and the expectation that there will be a positive outcome where they're going to gain something. And that's not strong enough on its own. There has to also be something very tangible and practical that they can lose if they don't accomplish the goal. I always ask my students, once they set up the first act, I'll say, okay, so what does she have to do? Well, she has to, if you look at, like, anybody see Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close? That was an interesting movie because, actually, the book was much better, but he needs to find that key, right? Because he feels like it's the key to understanding his father. It creates a central mystery because we don't know what lock the key will open. We don't know why he needs to find it. He doesn't know. To that kid, it feels like it's his lifeline to his father, who he lost in a very sudden, unexpected way. And it creates the whole story engine for the whole movie. When a character feels like, I have to accomplish this, or there'll be this void, this hole in my heart if I don't, that is strong enough, because at least there is the opportunity for some kind of connection with, you know, the father he lost. And at the same time, if he doesn't have it, he feels like he's going to be incomplete and that he's going to remain broken and he's for the rest of his life. The other thing that I like to talk about that I think a lot of people neglect is the role of mystery in telling a story.
Good answer.
Oh, somebody's on the phone. I thought he was saying I had a good answer. Which all screenplays will need to have a central question that will be embedded in the script. Many screenplays will also have a central mystery. The chapter in the book, What's the Missing Piece, talks about the idea of a central mystery. A central mystery is we're wondering what happened in the past that's causing the characters to be in this place where they currently are. How did his backstory inform on present activities. That's a central mystery. It's always going to be about the past, or it's going to be about the mythology. A central question is, what's going to happen in the movie? And suspense in a script is completely dependent upon a central question, because suspense is defined by two things. Suspense is defined by anticipation and surprise. That's the lifeblood of your screenplay. Anticipation is what's going to get us to stay glued to the screen. If you're reading a book and it's a page turner, there's suspense because it's compelling you to turn to the next page. If there isn't that anticipation, the script is not successful. And if there isn't that anticipation, that's when the audience gets bored in the movie theater. That's when you look at your watch, or you decide you're going to go get more popcorn or go to the bathroom. Because it's the line of the narrative of the story needs to stay taut. So if it's like a wire, when it sags, it's because the tension drops out. Part of what keeps the line taut is the collision of the positive and the negative energy, where while they're struggling to achieve one thing, there's the fear and the obstacles that are in the way that are fueling the potential negative consequences. But when it comes to mystery, I wanted to just – this is the one part I'm going to read from the book, and then I will talk a little bit about a couple of other little pieces, and then you can answer – well, you know, if anybody has questions. Okay, so this is Chapter 17, The Missing Piece. The exceptional screenwriter, director, executive producer, J.J. Abrams, maybe some of you have heard of him, did a TED Talk several years ago called The Mystery Box. Has anybody seen this? No? The Mystery Box. If you haven't seen it, it's only about 20 minutes long, and it's definitely worth checking out. Basically, when Abrams was a kid, his grandfather bought him a mystery box at a magic store. The packaging on the sealed box promised $15 for $50 worth of magic. Abrams explains to the audience that he still has this box in his office today. It sits on a shelf, and what's remarkable about this mystery box is that he's never opened it to this day. He talks about how the expectation of what's inside the box is its true magic, and as soon as he opens the box, the suspense and anticipation, the mystery, vanishes. So, when we go to the movies, it's like we're being handed our very own mystery box. The setup introduces us to characters in their world, then wrests them out of their usual routine and challenges them. At this point, if the movie is any good, it's arousing our curiosity, our need to know more. What protagonists don't know can hurt them. And one of the currencies of screenwriting, storytelling and screenwriting, is that audiences are more compelled by what they don't know than by what they do know. You know, and if you look at J.J. Abrams, you know, iconic, legendary TV series, Lost was completely fueled by the idea that every week you were hoping that you were going to understand why the hell they were on this island and what was really going on. To some, you know, in some cases, it was a little bit too mysterious and people got frustrated because it unfolded too slowly. But that was the idea. You had to wait until the season finale of Lost to be able to see what was really going on. He wasn't going to open the mystery box until that point. What audiences don't know will always, for the time being, be more interesting than what they do know. Great storytellers are always dangling a new plot development in front of our eyes, instilling in us the need to know more. When you're telling a story to kids, this will compel them to ask you, then what happens? Audiences don't outgrow these anticipatory instincts. It's as if there's another smaller mystery box and then another one inside that one and so on. And as we discover more and more layers of mystery, the storyteller is creating momentum for the audience to keep unwrapping and exploring. This momentum is called narrative drive. The fuel for narrative drive is the audience's curiosity. How do you make us curious and to want to know more about what's going to happen to the character? By creating an iconic character, one of the ways you're doing it is you're creating a character who we become invested in, who we care about. And you need to create a character who we're going to be worried about. We have to be worried what's going to happen to him or her. If we're not worried about what's going to happen, there's no suspense. You know, and if you only take one thing away from this little talk here, or even from the book, suspense is not generated by scary lighting and, you know, shadows and scary music. Suspense is completely dependent upon the audience's emotional investment in the characters. If we're not emotionally invested in what, you know, who they are and what's happening to them, It doesn't matter if somebody tries to kill them. It doesn't matter if they walk into a dangerous situation, because we're not invested in who the people are. I recently heard Matt Stone and Trey Parker, the creators of South Park and the Broadway smash The Book of Mormon, speaking to a screenwriting class at NYU Tisch School of the Arts. I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of their remarks on plotting was that if the connective tissue between scenes of your screenplay is and then, if that's what comes between each scene, and then this happens, and then this happens, and this happens, they said, you're totally screwed. And I agree. You don't want it to be, and then this happens, and then this happens. Have you ever been with somebody who's told a story where they keep saying, and then, and you want to jump out the window? What they said was, the connective tissue needs to be, but then. Their point, and it can't be underscored enough, is that but them invigorates us, and then lulls us. A central mystery usually concerns the past. A central question is about the future. A central mystery makes us wonder what happened and how is it affecting the present, and we're usually asking why or how. A central question makes us wonder what's going to happen next. Not all mysteries deal with deep, dark secrets. Many mysteries are about just something that's partially obscured, something that's not completely hidden, but just something that's a little bit hidden. As long as the characters keep trying to figure these things out in their lives, as long as they keep trying to solve the why, how, when, and where of their problems, then you have narrative drive. A big caveat is we have to care about them. They don't have to be likable, but they do have to have sympathetic goals. You know, you hear a lot about people get notes saying, you know, the character's not likable. Characters don't need to be likable. Sometimes a likable character is boring. The Denzel character in Flight is not particularly likable. I had a student in class just this past week, and somebody read her pages, and they said the character's not likable, and she said, you know, there's a book called Save the Cat about screenwriting, and he talks about you make a character compelling by having the character do something like save a cat from a burning tree, and that, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that a lot of Hollywood movies, you do have likable characters, but some of that's just it comes from casting. I think the bigger challenge is to create a character who is vulnerable. If a character has a core vulnerability, we will be compelled and we will care about them. And when we care about them, that's your ticket to suspense. I think every movie, no matter what genre you're writing, needs to be considered a suspense movie, because suspense is what's going to keep us glued to the screen. Okay, let me just tell you a couple of other little quick things here, and then we will see if anybody has any little questions. And one little thing here. Central conflict. When you come up with an idea for a movie, you know, I was going to talk today about that I'm not here to impart, you know, wisdom and information. I'm here to hopefully inspire you. And I want to inspire you because I think everybody has a story to tell. And if you're a visual person and you think in pictures, then you probably want to tell your story as a screenplay, because screenplays need to, you know, motion pictures. Part of the idea when you have a story that you really want to tell, the first thing you want to ask yourself is not necessarily, is this going to be commercial, or, you know, is it like another movie that just came out, or trying to predict what the trends are going to be. I think the first question you have to ask is, what's the emotional core of the story? You know, how is this going to make people feel? I do a lot of consulting now in different parts of the world. I work more now in Russia and Spain and France than I do in the United States. And a lot of it is because they have this, at this point, this very insatiable need to have their stories feel more like Hollywood movies, and to have more of an American storytelling feeling. And to me, I don't mean this to be, I'm not disparaging them at all, but it's like my approach is the same every time. It's almost a no-brainer where I say, well, what is the character feeling? What does she want? How does she feel about that? What's going to happen? But it's always about tapping into the emotions. If you look at really great movies, they make you feel something. You know, if they're making you laugh, cry, be afraid, They're going to challenge you. And the idea of creating a vulnerable character, because a vulnerable character, we might not like that character because they may be really frustrating, but we will care about them because they're vulnerable. Look at the Jack Nicholson character in As Good As It Gets. He's a horrible human. He's a terrible man, but he suffers from OCD, and he also performs an act of kindness for somebody. But before that, we still like him because he may be, well, he's Jack Nicholson, but, you know, he may be anti-Semitic, homophobic, racist, sexist, everything, but he can't step on sidewalk cracks, and he has to wash his hands 30 times a day with one bar of soap and then another bar of soap and another bar of soap. So we see that he struggles, and he has his own vulnerabilities. But by creating a vulnerable character, you're creating somebody who we're going to care about, hopefully, and we're going to worry about them. And emotionally, when we see a movie about a character who's vulnerable, or even a character who starts off very armored up, like in Hurt Locker, you know, this character is seemingly invincible, but we learn he's very vulnerable as the movie progresses. It's not just about making them a little bit vulnerable. It's about making them incredibly vulnerable. If you can push your characters to the edge, to the point where they're raw. I mean, think about putting them in situations where they're excruciatingly vulnerable. You know, one of the most biggest trends in television now is reality TV, right? I mean, it's been pervasive for many, many years now. Reality TV is all predicated on seeing people being incredibly vulnerable. You know, you see them with the potential to succeed and win, you know, money and fame, but there's probably many more people are watching to see them fall flat on their face or possibly humiliate themselves, but certainly be incredibly vulnerable. You know, you're in the spotlight. I see it when I go to baseball games, when it's, you know, bottom of the ninth and it's, you know, bases loaded, two outs. I just think I would not want to be that pitcher on the mound. I couldn't take that pressure, and yet you can't stop looking. You can't stop watching. You know, that's the part where the tension is amped up. And you need to write a script where you're building to that level of tension, you're pushing characters that far to the edge, and you're stripping away all of their defenses, where there's nothing left. All they can do is show up, be authentic, and be completely vulnerable. We all try to avoid vulnerability, and yet what we go to the movies to sit in our seat and have this vicarious experience of watching other people being vulnerable, and then we get to go home and probably just be exactly the way we were before we saw the movie. But by seeing characters face their fears and be forced to become more and more vulnerable, it's an itch that we kind of, I think, just collectively need scratched. We need to see characters pushed to the edge and to get to that point. If you look at a movie like Bridesmaids, which I actually really liked a lot, made me laugh a lot, and I write about it in the book, even though it's very popular entertainment. You know, the Kristen Wiig character, Annie, I mean, look how she humiliates herself over and over and over. And the more excruciatingly vulnerable she gets, the funnier the movie is. So it works in comedies, and it works in intense dramas like Flight. It works in movies like Schindler's List that talk about vulnerability. If you're not asking those questions, you're going to be on kind of more the superficial plane with your scripts. And, you know, there's always the argument that, yeah, but look at what's out in the movie theaters, and it's most of it's crap, and that's not what we see necessarily. But when you see great movies, there are people who take a stand, who put everything on the line for either love or a cause or to prove something to someone, maybe just to themselves. And I do feel like those are the movies we need to be writing. And those are the scripts that are very well received. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming. And I'm sure I'll be back next September when the new book comes out.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.